Good evening, everyone. Most of you I have seen before. A few are new faces. It's a great joy to see you or to see you again. This is the third or fourth or fifth night that we've been sharing Master's teachings here in this center. And last night I went over to Rajouri Garden. Is that how it's pronounced? Yeah. And then a few days I go on to Delhi, and I've been in India now for about 4, maybe 5 weeks on this, what is turning out for me at least to be just a marvelous chance to travel around and talk to all my new friends about the ancient teachings of these masters. Partly because I have no other responsibilities except doing this. Just for me personally, it's been a particularly enjoyable time, because the only thoughts in my head have been just sharing these teachings. I've been on this spiritual path since I was 22. I've been on the self-realization path since I was 18, but this line of masters since the age of 22, which is quite a few years when you count it up in human life terms. And there hasn't been one single day, and I mean that honestly, not one single day when I haven't been completely conscious of the extraordinary benefit of having come to these teachings and having them be the guideline for understanding and integrating whatever experience has come to me. It would be untrue to say every day has been blissful. That's hardly the case. But it really hasn't mattered if it's been difficult or effortless, because underneath it, there has always been the supportive understanding that what's happening to us in life is not arbitrary, it's not random, and it's not meant in any way to diminish us, but only to expand us and move us closer to what we all intuitively know is true, which is a state of perfect happiness, ultimately a state of perfect bliss. I've often thought about the fact that if we didn't intuitively know that we were born to be in a state of Satchidananda, we would be much more content to be miserable. Because if you know that misery is your absolute destiny and there's nothing you can do about it, a practical person just simply accepts that this is the way life is. Most of us live with the bodies that we have, and these are the bodies that we have. A friend of mine, I spent a period of days once with several men who are friends of mine, all of whom have very large physical bodies. You know, just not fat, but just big. Big hands, big heads, big elbows, big knees. And I became ridiculously focused on that. And finally, one of those men said to me, he said, "It doesn't feel large to me, Asha. It feels like exactly the right size." And I always have sort of enjoyed that fact that we make for ourselves both a physical body and circumstances that feel exactly like the right size to us. This is what our consciousness is capable of expressing. It's the natural next step for us to go forward. Now, our subject tonight is death, dying, and the astral world. Much of what I'll say, or I should say rather, this book, which we don't happen not to have any extra copies of in the house tonight, which you can get eventually, it's called Karma and Reincarnation. It should have been called Death, Dying, Karma and Reincarnation, but some people thought the words death and dying were not big sellers on the cover of a book. I personally disagreed, but my point of view wasn't carried. But this is a superb book on the subject, karma, reincarnation, death, and dying. In my own life, even before I came on the spiritual path, but especially afterwards, death to me has never even slightly seemed like what you might call a morbid subject, or a subject that one ought not to think about or not talk about. It always confused me, in fact, especially after I started reading about yogis in India, and Ramakrishna in particular, which was the first exposure I had to self-realization, teaching Sanatana Dharma from India. And one of his practices was to meditate in a cremation ground. And Vivekananda would go meditate in a cremation ground. And I don't know how you all feel about this, but that just seemed like such a marvelous practice to me. Finally, many years later, when I was able to come to India, because they don't have things like that in America, I was finally able to come to India, and I went to the cremation ground, where Ramakrishna, I think, his body was taken. Is that correct? No, it's where he used to go, actually. And I sat and meditated in the cremation ground, and it was ridiculous. I was so happy being there. And, of course, in many people's minds, that would be weird in the extreme. But to me, the fact of death has always been the surest affirmation that this life has a purpose, that we're not just here randomly going in circles forever with no possibility of graduating and going on to another reality. The fact also that this life is temporary and that at a certain point, everything that we call ourselves from the soul identified with the body, which is Yogananda's definition of ego, that all of that is going to dissolve, has always seemed intensely relevant to me. And I found it very difficult to imagine how people can make decisions in their daily life without keeping in mind what the ultimate result of this will be. Now, of course, I'm sure I've been a yogi for many lifetimes. I'm sure I've been the kind of yogi that did haunt the cremation grounds. So to me, it was sort of like a homecoming to come to such a place. I accept that it's odd, but that's who I am. I'm quite comfortable with it. But on a much more profound level, let me just a moment, let me get that thought as I want to say it. If we don't remember that we are just passing through here, we make very unfortunate decisions. And if we don't remember that we're just passing through here, we get ourselves all twisted up in what is success, what is the right response. It's paradoxical in this way. Let me speak to it. Swami Kriyananda, whose picture is here, he's, of course, the American disciple of Yogananda and my teacher, the man who has really brought me through to everything that I, whatever I may know, I owe to him. More than any of us, Swami Kriyananda is perfectly aware of the transitory nature of this world. In fact, when he speaks about his childhood, what he really describes is until about the age of 8 or 9, he lived as much in the astral world as he did in this world. And he said he always felt, even from a very small age, that this world was not his home. And when he would go to sleep at night, Swamiji described that he would see a golden light, and he would concentrate on that light, and then gradually he would his sense of awareness would expand, and he would merge into that light, and that's how he went to sleep. And it was many years in his life before he found out that wasn't how everyone went to sleep. And only when he became 9 years old, in fact, and he was stricken with a severe ailment, which turned out to be colitis. And also, he said, about the age of 8 or 9, he became aware of the fact that his perception of reality was very different from the perception that other people had. And he began to feel uncomfortable with the difference, whereas in early childhood, he was perfectly comfortable with it. He began to feel uncomfortable with it, and he felt the need to relate more to this world. Secondarily, he also became very ill, and he had a lot of delirium because he had such a high fever. And he said, and when he came out of that, he was slightly suspicious of altered states of mind. And it was just a karmic testing period for him, which lasted until just before he turned 22, when he read Autobiography of a Yogi and found Yogananda. And at that point, he came back to where he had been. In fact, he said something very interesting. He said after he was initiated into Kriya and began to meditate, he said he went right back to merging into that light, into the superconscious state he had known so naturally as a child. And he made the interesting comment that as soon as he went back into that state, he said no time had passed, because in superconsciousness there is no time. So all of the intervening years of struggle and strain and looking for his place in the world, as soon as he stepped back into the superconsciousness, they all disappeared. It was just one continuous experience. He was back where he had been, and as if nothing had happened in between. Now, it's not exactly like that when we pass from this world, but there is a sudden realization when we step out of our bodies. Now, I speak of this. This is a combination of what I have learned from others and what I seem to know intuitively. I have to say that, because I've never had out-of-body experiences and I can't look back and remember my incarnations. But somehow there are certain things, and I'm sure all of you know this, that you just know. And you don't know exactly how you know it or why you know it, but the only explanation is that you've experienced, we have experienced it enough times that the samskaras, the past impressions are so deep on us that even though we can't quite reach into it, there's just the doubt has been resolved by experience. So there's this awareness when we pass out of this body. It's like Swamiji coming back to that state of superconsciousness. Oh, yes, this is just something I put down somewhere and now I found it again. And when we live in this world, what this world tries to persuade us of is that the experiences we are having now are the only experiences we will ever have, or are in some way the only really important experiences. And there's that shocking realization that people tell us who go to the other side and then return, when they realize how confused they were about everything that happened. There's a lot of books these days, partly because of the increase of medical technology, in which people who exited their bodies were not able to come back. But now, because of a lot of the medical technology, the body can crisis and return. I also think there's another thing happening, which is we are advancing into a higher age of awareness. And so these experiences are happening more and more so that people will be inspired, ultimately forced, to come to a much more expanded understanding of what life is. My absolute favorite story of someone who experienced physiological death and came back was Dr. George Ritchie, is his name. The book used to be called Return from Tomorrow. It actually has another name now, I don't know what it is. But this man, he was in the U.S. Army, and he was 21 years old. And as it happened, he had a desire to be a doctor. And there was he was stationed, I think, in Texas, and there was a huge flu epidemic. And many people were killed in the flu epidemic, and he was a soldier in this camp, and he died. And he found himself suddenly in the other world, and he was going through what many people tell us you have to go through, which is all of a sudden, from that perspective, you look back over your life, and you have to describe, you have to review and evaluate and try to understand whether or not your life was a success. Now, on this side, we ask, how much property did I own? You know, did my children become highly educated? Was I recognized for my talents? All the different things that we ask, that we think are what you might call the purpose of life experience. So this man died at the age of 21. And there were a couple of unique characteristics to his upbringing, including the fact that his mother had died when he was young, And his father had remarried, and the stepmother had tried very hard to mother him, but the boy remained close to her. And his grandparents, his mother's parents, had encouraged the boy to be rude to the stepmother. And he had allowed that negative influence to influence him. And among other things, but that was the biggest blot. So he believed devoutly in Jesus Christ. And so when he died, the Savior, as he called him, Jesus Christ, appeared to him, and he found himself in a room, he said, with what he described as a 360-degree movie screen that was just floor to ceiling all around him, and every single incident of his life was happening simultaneously. He saw his conception. He saw the moment that he entered his mother's womb. He saw being born. He saw himself as an infant. And he was conscious of his own consciousness in all of those states. Merely because we can't remember it with our minds doesn't mean that it's not registered in our chakras, in our subconscious, however you might call that. He was also conscious of the fact that there was almost nothing to be proud of in all of those years, all of those 21 years. He saw how cruel he'd been to his stepmother, how small-minded his grandparents were, how he'd allowed himself to buy into their small-mindedness. And it's just nothing. And Jesus kept saying to him, "How much have you loved?" That was the only question Jesus asked. How much have you loved? And all around him, he could see not very much. Even though there had been countless opportunities, he'd rejected almost all of them. And he found himself trying to justify himself to Jesus. "I'm only 21. I haven't really had much of a chance. You know, how can you hold me responsible? I was just a kid." And he said, Jesus, very calmly, just repeat the question, "How much have you loved?" And he was mortified by his life. And then he tells this story that he said the only really notable, laudable thing was that he'd been an Eagle Scout and he'd done something generous somewhere along the line. So he saw over here the action, the generous action, and he said he, as much as possible, he tried to block Jesus' view of everything else as he pointed out this good action like this, hoping that Jesus wouldn't look at the rest of it. And he said, in that moment, there was this profound telepathic communication with his guru, is how he felt Jesus to be. And he said, and he had a southern accent slightly, he said, "Jesus was amused by that. He was amused by my efforts to hide from him." And he said, in that moment, he just surrendered everything. And he realized, one, he was in the presence of the personification of love. And that's why Jesus kept saying to him, "How much have you loved?" Because when the divine appears to us, it is nothing but love. And also the fact that his guru, and the fact that it was Jesus' incidental, understood him completely. And far from judging and condemning and sending him to hell, which is all of these terrible things we imagine, he not only was kindly disposed, he found his foibles amusing, something to laugh about, not laugh at, but laugh together. And that's also what George Ritchie described at that point, is that he himself suddenly became completely lighthearted. You know, just exactly the opposite picture that we have. Now, even in human terms, if we think about what it is to have true friends, if we think about what it is to have people in this world who are really on our side, and really want the best for us. I pray that all of you have at least one or two people in your life whose love and support for you, you can absolutely trust. So that even no matter how much you mess up, their attitude towards you will always be sympathetic and supportive. Okay, what will we do now? I went to Swami Kriyananda once, and he had given me a fairly important life direction. And I found myself, it was a good idea, I could see it was a good idea, and I absolutely could not do it. It was just my own desires, my own restlessness, I just couldn't do it. And I didn't want to be hypocritical with him. So I said, sir, I want you to know you've asked me to follow this course of action. I can't. I'm following this course of action. I don't even think he took an extra breath after I finished saying it. He just said, well, so much for theory. He said, let's work now with reality. And then immediately, okay, if that's who you are, then let's see how we can make the best of where you are and where you're going. Now, in reflecting upon it and thinking of Dr. Ritchie's story, that's exactly the way the divine works with us. You have to appreciate that God, Guru, and Divine Mother know something that we tend to forget, which is that our ultimate victory over all delusion and all suffering is absolutely guaranteed. That's a hard thing to embrace at all times, but it's a fundamental and profoundly important part of the spiritual path. We are the river seeking the ocean, and no matter how many obstacles we have to overcome, no matter how deep the valley, no matter how long we flow backwards away from the ocean, sooner or later, every river finds its way to the sea. Someone wrote me once and asked, at what point does the soul begin to search for God? And I said, at what point does the river begin to flow toward the sea? And from the perspective of the divine, they see not only the present time of the story, but they see also the end of the story. If you're dealing even with your own child, and you know that the upset the child is going through right now is just temporary, they'll outgrow it, circumstances will change, you can be profoundly compassionate for the suffering that they're going through, and we should be compassionate for that suffering. But your relationship to their suffering is completely informed by the fact that you know this is just temporary, and they'll come out of it, and some other reality will come to them. Now, our happiness comes when we can just step back just that tiny bit from our own personal involvement in our own life and just see ourselves as we truly are. What confuses us terribly on the spiritual path is that we're so involved with ourselves. Swami Kriyananda uses the word impersonal. You need to be impersonal. And he doesn't mean that you need to be cold with your friends. The one you need to be impersonal about is yourself. That yes, I'm operating this particular system, but I don't have to identify with it. And I've spoken in this room about that, so I won't go there deeply again. But we just be a little bit impersonal. I am the river seeking the sea. And whatever valley I'm in right now, it's just the valley I'm in right now. Because once we reach the end of this story, which is the moment of our death, we just walk away from it all. Actually, I was remembering just now, one of the things that really impelled me to the spiritual path, and I suppose this is why I've always had a certain affection for death. I remember I was about 18, actually I think it was before I started studying any self-realization. I had friends, and I wasn't a lonely person or anything like that. But I remember one night when I was falling asleep, I started thinking of the moment of my death. And I realized that when it came, it would be now. You know, from a certain age, it's in the future. But when it happens, it's now. And I realized also that when that moment came, absolutely no one and nothing of the world that I was in, no matter how much people loved me, I would gradually become completely alone. And in my imagination that night, and I sort of remember that I was awake much of the night, and I don't know if I went into a semi-dream state or I didn't know how to meditate, so I wasn't doing that. But I imagined every possible circumstance, including moving from here to another planet, just everything I could think about. But no matter how elaborate the situation, sooner or later, there was going to be that moment. And I didn't understand even what that moment was the way that I do now. But that moment would come when everything would shift. And as I say, it became intensely important for me to understand what that was about. And it seemed intensely important to me that everything you did up until that moment would have to be focused toward that moment, not in a morbid way. But of course, now as a devotee, now with the idea of reincarnation and karma and God's grace and the astral world, which is what we're talking about, I have come to understand that consciousness is what we really are. And in fact, even as we live in this body, if you think about it at all we ever experience is our consciousness. If you have any acquaintances or friends who are subject to depression or unhappy moods, you can be right next to such a person. You can be having exactly the same experiences together, or maybe it's you who are having the experience, and exactly the same external events will be processed completely different by the internal orientation. One person will find every reason to be sad, the other will find every reason to be happy. The same situation, where our meditation hall was for a time, now we have a different location in California, there was a nightclub across the street, and they played very raucous music with a really hard beat. And late one night, I came out of our meditation hall, which was situated in such a way that it was completely silent. But I came out onto the sidewalk, and there were swarms of people trying to get into the nightclub. And even under the sidewalk, I could feel that pounding beat, and I could feel the waves of the bass going through my system. And all those people were trying to get in, and I thought, that would be my definition of hell, to be taken into that club. You know, to be subject to all that rajasic energy and that, to my mind, horrible sound. And I just thought, it's all consciousness. It's all what people take away from the input that comes to them based on their vibrations, their refinement, their lack of it. And the fact about death, Swami Kriyananda has said emphatically on many occasions, nothing happens. That's what he says. I love the way he says that. Nothing happens. We think that this great thing is going to happen, but all we're ever experiencing is consciousness. And our consciousness is not shifted by the mere taking off of the body. Now, Master speaks in most interesting ways, though, about the actual process of dying. In this book, it talks about the stages of dying, how the body actually, we enter the body from the medulla down, and we exit the body backwards like that. And so our body tends to die, unless we die suddenly. But if we're dying over any period of time, our body will die from the periphery. That's why the hands and feet become really cold. A person who's losing, you know, whose soul is leaving, they often experience paralysis from the limbs, and that will gradually go up. When I was with a friend of mine as she was dying, you know, I just watched her. And then her breath just, you know, moved up. You know, first she was breathing here, then she was breathing here, and then all of it just stopped piece by piece until it was just finally here, and then finally she was gone from her body. And let's see, just a moment, I lost the thought. Let me find it. Yogananda said it, Master put it this way. He said, if you've done any meditation at all or anything that has expanded your awareness beyond the body and have experienced yourself as consciousness without needing the intermediary stimulation of the senses. Now that's what we're doing when we meditate. Those of you who have Kriya understand it on a more sophisticated level. We've shut off what Master calls the sense telephones. We're not receiving any stimulation into the body, but without any stimulation, we're still experiencing consciousness. And in fact, we're experiencing more and more expanded consciousness. And on the highest level of meditation, even your breath and heart will stop, that your physical body becomes completely not part of the experience, but you are still there. So Master describes that if you've had any experiences sufficient to tell you that consciousness exists without the physical body, he said you can experience the death of the body without losing consciousness. You will just observe that your body is dying and that your brain will die, but that you're still there. But, Master said, those who believe that consciousness is dependent upon the brain, and this is how he put it, well, when the brain begins to die and finally dies, they will feel obligated to go unconscious. That's how he put it, because they just can't imagine that it's possible to be conscious now that their body is dead. And those who have more refined awareness simply notice that the body is dead, and then they just go on from there. They step out of it, like all the movies are showing us how we do. And Master says, and whatever state of consciousness we have, whatever our final state of consciousness is, we are simply drawn into the astral universe that matches that vibration. And so the way that we die, the consciousness with which we die, it's a very important element. Swami Kriyananda has an essay in the book Religion in the New Age called The Final Exam. And he, for example, he tells this story about a disciple of Master who was in the hospital in his last days. And Swami Kriyananda, as a young disciple then, went to visit this man. And he was on his deathbed and he was saying, oh, I've done so many wrong things in my life. I've done so many wrong things. And when Swamiji went back and told Master, that made Master very, very sad. Because he said, I wish he wouldn't take into his next life. You know, why die with such a sense of failure? And you start like that, then you go into an astral universe with that kind of point of view, and the way that you come across in your next life is all influenced by that. You see, children are influenced with whatever, they're from the womb, they have personalities, because they bring with them, totally intact, the consciousness that they've had. And it, to me, this reality is so encouraging for this simple reason. Whatever condition we have in our lives now, if we want it to be better, whatever efforts we make toward making it better will absolutely bear fruit and make it happen. And the only thing that really matters in the end is what Jesus asked Dr. George Ritchie, how much have you loved? Because everything else goes away except the fundamental orientation of our consciousness. You don't have your wardrobe, you don't have your stock portfolio, you don't have your furniture. I mean, it sounds like a joke to say that, but when you go into the astral world, there's nothing material there. You literally just go to the vibration that is your consciousness. So every day, every year, what vibration of consciousness am I developing? Am I manifesting? Am I sharing with others? If you're standing in front of God and Guru at the end of your life, I often play out my life review. I find it a very helpful thing to do. In fact, I had a very difficult decision that I had to make once in my life, and I had to choose a certain path, and I wasn't sure if it was the right decision, and other people were involved, and I realized if I don't come to complete peace with this, I could become very annoyed with other people. I mean, that's sort of summing it up in a certain way. And I had to face the fact, this is the part of it that was important. I had to face the fact that maybe I was making a terrible mistake. and that maybe the result of this action would not be all that great. But I said to myself, if I make my consciousness anxiety about whether this is a mistake or not, then that will be the vibration that I live with. And when I asked Swami Kriyananda, is this the right or the wrong thing to do? His answer was perfect. He said, it's just a thing. He said, whether it turns out right or wrong depends entirely on your consciousness as you do it. So even if we've made ridiculous decisions and just, you know, squandered every opportunity we can think of, all of those conditions will disappear. And the only thing that we'll have left that we take into the astral world is the vibration of consciousness we have as a result of the life that we've lived. Once when I also was dealing in myself with a certain insecurity about properly using the gifts that I felt God had given me. And I was becoming like that man on his deathbed, always thinking about what I wasn't doing. And I came up with this most ridiculous idea, which actually worked beautifully. I decided that instead of thinking of all my inadequacies, I would make the best of my small virtues. And I started saying, I'm a pretty nice person, just like that. And every time I would feel terribly insecure about my success or my lack of success, I would say, well, you know, when you added it all up, I'm still a pretty nice person. And I literally would imagine myself dying and facing Master. And he said, well, how did it go? I said, well, I squandered a lot of the potential I had, but in the end, I was a pretty nice person. And really, literally, in meditation, I would just sort of work that out with him. And, you know, maybe it wasn't as glorious as I wanted it to be, but being a pretty nice person is okay. And that was what I was saying about putting ourselves in relationship in my life review, which you will have, we all will have. How will it all really add up? And if it's not adding up now, don't think it's going to add up any better then. You know, nothing is going to happen when you, just because you die, you'll just step over. Now, here's another aspect of the dying process that has always inspired me. I mentioned in here Stephen Levine, who in America was a very influential person in helping us to get a more expanded idea of the dying process and how it should work. And he described this reality of what happens when a person begins to die, if you have a more gradual death. And he said, most of us are in the habit, when there is any kind of a restlessness in our consciousness, that because we have the capacity to move our bodies and do things with our bodies, we tend to try to ease any discomfort in our consciousness by physical action or physical movement. I'm a little restless. I think I'll go outside for a walk. I've been staying in the guest room. It felt the other day I realized there were no open windows in here, and I just suddenly I needed to get outside. So we went out and we took a walk around the park. I'm a little lonely. I'll go find someone and talk to them. I'll dial a number on the telephone. I'm hungry. I want to do some creative work. And you just get up and do it as a rule. And we rarely realize that we're just responding to a restless consciousness. Now, a great yogi can just sit in perfect peace for hours and days even. There's no impulse in him to do anything. You have Neem Karoli Baba and Lahiri Mahashaya and others who, and Ramana Maharshi, you know, they didn't do very much. There was no dissonance in their consciousness that required release or distraction by physical movement. Now, what Stephen Levine wrote is that if your body begins to die in such a way that it takes time for it to die, you gradually lose the capacity to move and to do the things that you would normally do. A woman friend of mine who had cancer and died from cancer, she was lying on her bed and her head was twisted a little bit like this,
And her friend said to her, "That must be uncomfortable. Why don't you put your head elsewhere on the pillow?" She looked at her and she said, "You have no idea what effort it would take for me to move my head at this point." And then Stephen describes how people who have only solved the problems of consciousness by acting through their bodies can become terribly restless and afraid when they are just trapped inside their consciousness and have lost the capacity to distract themselves through their bodies. And he talked about a stage of dying where people become very, very anxious because the dissonance of their consciousness is displaying itself and they can't do anything to change it. Now, almost always, a sense of peace settles in after that, which you'll often see. There'll be a period of agitation and then there'll be a period of peace. The point for me that I've taken as a life lesson from death is to try as much as possible to solve the problems of consciousness on the level of consciousness. If I'm feeling angry or upset or restless, it may well be. I mean, we don't just have to sit in our rooms. We have to be practical. But even if I do get up and go for a walk, before I get up and go for a walk, try to bring myself to a state of peace. Try to bring myself to an understanding that I'm doing this not because I have to, but because it's the right thing to do. People spend money a lot. Because, I mean, especially in America where there's a lot of money flowing and there's so many things you can buy all the time, maybe it's the same here, they feel restless and inadequate in their minds, and so they go out and spend money. I've been flying through Dubai recently. It's been a convenient flight, San Francisco, Dubai. And it's sort of an interesting place to stop. Dubai, in answer to all the festivals they have in India, has a perpetual shopping festival going on. And they call it the phrase retail therapy. You know, your consciousness is restless, you feel inadequate, spend money, buy things. Completely ineffective. But we don't know that. Because sooner or later, all problems of consciousness will have to be settled on the level of consciousness. That's what it is to advance spiritually. We have to be realistic with ourselves. But at least if we know in the general direction we're going, and then when we have to shift into the astral world, we just shift as happily as we can be. Oh, it's been a great experience. A gentleman who worked a lot in America with the dying process, he had another interesting point. He said, someone asked him, "You talk about how joyful and free people are when they exit their body, and Yogananda talks about this. He makes the most interesting statement in this book. He says, as the paralysis comes up the body and the heart becomes paralyzed, that makes it impossible for the lungs to work. And he says, there are 2 or 3 seconds of a kind of panic concern. And then it's over. Then you're out of your body. He said, those 2 or 3 seconds can plant in a person's mind a great deal of fear of death. He said, I love that he just wrote it like that. Oh, it's 2 or 3 seconds. I mean, think how short that is. That, oh well, I'm not going to be able to breathe anymore, but I don't need my body even to breathe because breath is just an indication of a higher, of the energy flowing through me, and that energy is going to keep flowing. As Master also writes in there, he says, our base of operations after we leave our physical body becomes the astral body. I loved our base of operation. Our base of operation now is the physical body. As soon as the physical body is finished, the astral body becomes that. And this world that we see around us is a grosser version of the astral world. And people, it's very interesting, people try to create in the physical world the astral worlds they come from. And one of the reasons why it's a very beneficial thing to create harmony and beauty in the world that you live in. You don't have to create luxury, but to create harmony, cleanliness, and beauty is because how we live in this world is, again going to be a reflection of the astral universe that we're from. And what astral vibrations do we want to channel?
disorder, messiness, and India has a lot to learn in this respect, and I can't even begin to touch what the causes are. But, dirt and disorder invites lower astral vibrations, and beauty and harmony invite higher astral vibrations. Our community in Palo Alto, Ananda doesn't own it, but a group of investors purchased an apartment complex for us, and then we took a master lease, and then we rented out. That's how our community operates. It's by no means ideal, but it works. When we took over, it was a very low vibration. That was one of the reasons we could afford it, because it was a little rundown. But what was fascinating to me was it was a rundown place, and then inside of it, people made it worse. Everything was dark. There was a great deal of disorder. They kept the curtains closed all the time. Things were painted dark colors. It was like the astral universe that these people came from. They came into the physical universe and they tried to make the same astral universe they were used to. There was nothing light. There was nothing expansive. There was nothing harmonious about it. They just recreated it right there. We came into exactly the same spaces. The astral universe we came from was full of sunlight. It was full of white. It was full of light, bright colors. It was orderly. It was clean. Exactly the same buildings. We couldn't afford really to change the buildings, but we just changed the vibration. Because how you live in this world ends up being the vibration of your consciousness. And that, as I say, luxury isn't the point, but the vibration of how you live becomes the vibration of your consciousness, and it'll be the world you see. If the world you see is a certain way, when you go to the astral world, that's the only world you see. Master said some people in the astral world never wake up because they don't know they can be conscious without physical bodies, and all of their life experience has been only on a gross physical plane. So he said they just sleep. He called it kind of a gray dream. They get kind of a convalescent period. And then when they find themselves in another body with the physical sensations, then they begin to wake up again. But others, I will say people like us, who actually, our understanding of life is more on a subtle level. It's more this world that is the difficult one and doesn't seem like home. It's like, why are people not harmonious? Why are things not uplifting and beautiful? Why can't they see that disorder is so detrimental to what we're trying to accomplish here? And so we think about this refined astral world. And so when we lose the confinement of the physical body, we just step naturally into the place where we belong. Even though I can certainly complain about India on the physical level, when I first came, the first time ever I came, it was like the vibration of this culture, and as Swami describes it, the vibration that comes out of the land, which is not about what's happening now, but what's happened so long. It was like I exhaled. It felt so much like home to me, and I've always felt that. When we were coming once or twice a year, my husband and I would say that India was like a vitamin for us, and we would develop a deficiency, and we would just need to come back. It was a homeland. I think I've reconstituted myself so I can move in and out of it without that same, but there would be a hunger for this vibration. Just like there gets to be a hunger for refinement, a hunger for beauty, a hunger for harmony, because we're remembering those worlds. And if we recognize that, yes, it is our duty to manifest those vibrations as much as we can here, which is why Ananda always tries to make a certain level of refined beauty wherever we are, not because we have to, but because that's the astral world we're from. And that's the world we want to live in, and that's the world we want to channel into this world. And then also when we step out of this world, that's where we'll go. Master himself was like that. The age of too much poverty is not really where we're standing. That's why India itself is trying to come out of this karmic period, not because materialism or materialistic is really a good idea, but this kind of disorder in the universe is also not a good idea. And it has to be, we have to be lifted from that.
All of this is because we're on this huge continuum, this just huge continuum in which this life is just a practice. It's a practice to manifest the right consciousness so that when we leave this body, we leave it with the right consciousness. Master also said, you know, this is the point of ego here, and this is the point of the spiritual eye. And he said, when the energy begins to come back up the spine at death, it just sort of rolls back up the way it rolled down at the beginning. He said, if our consciousness is elevated and we're thinking about the divine, when we die, we rise up into the spiritual light. If our consciousness is still ego-centered, as we begin to die, instead of our energy expanding upward, it just collapses backwards. And we fall back into ego identification, and then that also determines where we go next in the world. A friend of mine died very, very consciously. Well, several friends have, but she had all her friends with her. She had all of us with her, and she died in the hospital. And she sort of finished everything. I won't tell the whole story. Well, maybe I will. She was there for about 3 days, and she knew that it was the end of her life. It was the third time she had cancer. She was only 40 years old. And for 3 days, she had all her friends in the hospital. First, my husband and I had been on vacation, as it were, in Costa Rica. And she went back into the hospital, and they tried to do some procedure on her, and then it was perfectly clear that nothing was... Well, we got the word that something, she'd gone into a convulsion, and they all thought she was going to die. And we thought she had died. We were very sad, but we knew, we'd heard it was coming. But then we never heard a final word. So when we were flying back from Costa Rica, we had a certain stop in a certain city, and if she was still alive, we wanted to go one direction. If she wasn't, we would go the other. So at that point, we made a phone call, and we'd been out of touch. This was before mobile phones. And her brother answered the phone. And we said, you know, here we are. It's Asha and Dave and his sister's Paula. He said, Paula's just been dying to know where you are. That's what she said. And then we heard this huge laugh in the room. No, Paula's been not dying to know just where you are. So we went there, and then for 3 days we were with her. And she had bad cancer, and she was on morphine, but she was still totally conscious. For 3 days, she systematically finished all the karma that she had with everyone. And she either called people on the telephone or asked them to come in. And it was amazing what she did, because she was absolutely honest, but she created harmony. And I'll give you one example. She'd had a terrible blow-up with this woman at one point in history. They were all part of Ananda, but she had been in charge of a community. That woman really had to be relieved from the responsibilities that she had, because she really had to be relieved from those responsibilities. It was just a necessary thing. But the woman who had been fired always held a certain resentment against Paula for doing it. And when Paula called her on the phone, with perfect honesty, she said, "I've always felt badly about the way things turned out," she said. She didn't say, "I did the wrong thing and you had a terrible attitude." She said, "I've always felt badly about the way things turned out." And then so sweetly she said, "I think we're both big enough gals to put it behind us now. Don't you think so?" And it was just, it was exactly what had to be said. It was truth, perfection, but harmony was more important. And she just went through like that. And finally, like on the last day, here's just another joke. She always really liked coffee. And she had a kind of complex relationship with coffee, because this was the third time she'd had cancer. People were always telling her that she needed to change her diet or something. So she would go on and off coffee, but she really loved coffee. My husband likes coffee too. So on that last day, David, my husband, says to her, "Is there anything you would like?" She said, "I would like a cup of coffee." I mean, she's on her last day. "I would like a cup of coffee." And she starts to tell him how she wants it. "Oh," he said, "Paula, I know just how you like it." So he went out and got her a perfect cup of coffee. She held it in her hand. She couldn't eat,
So she'd put a swab in it, and she would just put it in her mouth so she could taste the flavor of it. Toward the very end of her life, she was in and out of consciousness, and David tried to take the coffee away from her, and she woke up. She said, "I'm not done with it yet." Just like that. But it was so just marvelous. And then at a certain point, really literally, she just looked at it like that. She set it down. She didn't pick it up again. She was finished with it at that point. And then she had the supplemental oxygen. She took it off. Just all very deliberate. And we asked her, oh my God, she was such a pure soul. I said, I was sitting with her, is there anything left? And she thought about this man that she had an argument with, but he had already died, so there was nothing she could do. She said, well, I was so mad at him once that when he gave me a rose bush, I didn't plant it for a whole month. She said like that. We also looked at each other and thought, oh Lord, please, at the end of our lives, let it just be a rose bush that we didn't plant for 30 days. But when she actually was passing, she was sort of asleep for a while, and then it was about 3 in the morning, and she woke up and she just said to everyone, wake up, wake up! You know, everyone, and we were all sort of sleeping. There were like 25 or 30 of us all over the hospital. We all came in. And then she just got very quiet. And here was another moment, amazing moment. Her husband, whom she liked, she cared for very much, had been with her the whole time, and he would often sit close to her. In that last moment, he sat next to her, and he put his arm around her. And she turned to him just like this and said, don't touch me, I can still feel it. Meaning, don't distract me, it's over now. You know, and it was just like, she'd been as sweet to him as she possibly could be, but it's over now, just like that. And, you know, then he respected her and he backed away. And then she was sitting up for a while, and then she said very poignantly to us, this is very difficult, you have to help me. Because she was trying to just consciously let go of her body and not fall back into ego, but go into the light. And so we all started chanting Om, just the whole room chanting Om very quietly and steadily. And she was sitting up, and she looked up, and she said, God, Christ, Guru. And that's the last word she spoke. And then we just sort of listened to her breathe, just for maybe 5 or 10 minutes longer, and then one long exhalation, and she was gone. No. That's the way God intends for it to be. Fully loving, she was with everyone, she loved her husband, she loved her friends, but when it's over, it's over. Because this is what's supposed to happen. Afterwards, Swamiji said, I think she was liberated. He said, you can't die like that unless your consciousness is... Now here's an interesting thing about her. There was so much confusion in her life in other ways. She wasn't a perfect success on any level. But when she met Master and Master asked her, how much did you love? The answer to that was, with all my heart, every minute of my life. And that's the power that resolves in the way we want it to resolve, and that's why we were born. And it's up to us then how we die. So, any thoughts or questions or ideas? Yes, Sumitra.
You were talking about gentle, gradually soul moving out. What happens to sometimes when it is a sudden, could be an accident or somebody being killed or something like that?
Master says right here, just actually see if I can just find it because it's worth reading. The question was, I'm talking about slow, gradual dying. What happens if it's really sudden? I'm not sure I can find it, but what here Master writes right in this book, when sudden death comes, there's usually no fear at all and no pain. And he actually says, even if you're the victim of somebody else's violence, he says, he speaks of murder or violent death, he says, usually there's no pain and no fear. Because it just comes at you and you know that you're gone. And in fact, sudden death is not really such a bad thing at all if you've lived your life well. sometimes when sudden death comes, though, people don't know they're dead, and that's a little confusing. When the World Trade Center blew up in America, people who had that sensitivity said the subways were just full of ghosts, of people who couldn't figure out where they were. They'd been sitting at their desk making multimillion-dollar deals, and then they were in the astral world. And there was a lot of work for people who knew how to help transition people to help get them across. Because our imagination about death is so different than death itself that they didn't really know. Again, whenever I hear things like that, I think, well, what can we do to make ourselves ready? A woman friend of mine, her husband, he'd had some illnesses, but she didn't really know he was about to die. He got up from bed in the night, he walked into the bathroom, and he died as he stepped into the bathroom. He thought he was stepping into the bathroom, and instead he stepped into the astral world. And so often when I'm standing at the door of the bathroom, I think, you know, what happens if? But why not? Because we never actually know. We have it all figured out in our minds what it's going to be like, but we never know. Swamiji says every night you should build a bonfire and you should put everything that you are into that bonfire. The way I think about it is I really like to stay current. I don't like to carry karmic debts. I don't like to carry anger with people, unresolved issues. I mean, I'm a little extreme. Somebody will call and say, I'd like to talk to you. I have, you know, an issue I want to discuss, even if it's not about me. How about now? You know, it's just like if something comes up, let's just do it now. Let's just solve it now. We don't even know if there's going to be another moment. And if issues are not settled, don't just wait for them. It's kind of a joke with my husband sometimes when he leaves home in the morning. Goodbye, darling. It's been wonderful living with you. I always want you to know how much I've enjoyed being married to you. Someone will say, how does he take that? Well, he's accustomed to it by now. But it's a real spiritual exercise. It's like we never know what's going to happen next. And do we really want to die annoyed with our neighbor, annoyed with our son, annoyed with our husband? I mean, we can't always conquer our feelings so quickly. But it doesn't hurt to say, if when I step into the bathroom, I actually step into the astral world, do I want to have anything on my conscience that's just going to confuse me? Because those attachments will totally confuse you. You'll be trying to go to the astral world and simultaneously being dragged back. Oh, there's another story about Paula that I'll tell. This was long before she was ill. She ran a clothing store for Ananda. She had a beautiful aesthetic sense and an intuition about buying and what would people want and so on. And she had a bad cough. And she had a bottle of cough medicine that had codeine in it. And she's a little unsystematic in her life. So she was just kind of sipping the bottle a lot to try to keep the cough at bay because she was at this buyer's market. So by the time she got to her hotel room that night, she had seriously overdosed on this codeine. And she really felt that she was dying, that she'd poisoned herself. And she was so drugged that she couldn't get to the telephone or anything like that. And somehow she crawled into the bathroom. She thought if she could splash water on her face that it might revive her. And she said she saw the tunnel of light, and she started going down the tunnel of light. She was really leaving her body. And then two things happened. Somehow or another, the toilet seat was up, and she was staring into the toilet bowl. And she said, am I going to die staring into the toilet bowl? It was just such a gruesome prospect. And then the next thing that happened, Paula had a huge wardrobe, and she was the same size her whole life. All of us just got clothes and jewelry and shoes after she died. I mean, it just was boxes and boxes of things that were passed out to us. And she was staring into the toilet bowl, but also going into the tunnel of light, and she remembered this outfit that she had put on layaway. You know that she was going to... She's dying, and she's thinking about this outfit. And she said when she started thinking about that outfit, she came back out of the tunnel. I mean, it was like this attachment to this physical thing brought her back. I asked her later, I said, did you buy it in gratitude for it saving your life? She said, absolutely not. But that is how it is. We start, now we may not save our lives with our attachments, although people will come back to life. Sometimes positively, I can't leave my young child. I can't leave my husband. But also we'll be going into the light and the memory of the things that we're still attached to will pull us back away from that light. We'll still leave our bodies, but we won't go as into as elevated a state as we could if we were free. So just because a person dies suddenly or violently or in an accident or something like that doesn't mean that they can't just go to the light when it happens. They will go exactly where their consciousness is. Mahatma Gandhi, of course, is the most famous example of violent death responded to with high consciousness. But many others can. If you die, you can't cheat. You just die exactly who you are. And if you were a good person and for some reason you have the karma to have something unexpected happen to you, all that goodness will carry you. You won't become somebody else in that moment. Any other questions? Yes, sir, Danette.
Some people are frustrated and they commit suicide. What happened?
What about suicide? All karma is temporary. So even though the karma for suicide is not really terrifically good, everything can be overcome in the end. It depends to a certain extent, Swamiji has said, on why you commit suicide. God is not cruel or not understanding. If you commit suicide in anger in order to hurt other people, that would be far worse than if you commit suicide in despair over tragic situations in your life, or in confusion where you didn't really realize what you were doing. One explanation I've heard of the karma of suicide, which is a little chilling, is that whatever has driven you to the point in your life where you took your own life, you have to keep re-experiencing, not necessarily those exact circumstances, but that degree of desperation and have the courage to go through it. The biggest problem with suicide, very simply, is that it accomplishes nothing. And it also plants in your subconscious mind the idea of trying to escape. And you don't always remember when you return again that it didn't work. You may just try it again and again. And in fact, they say it becomes a karmic pattern that you will try suicide again and again. A woman friend of mine who has the vibration of a person who would commit suicide but hasn't. But she told me, she said, it's just always in her mind. And I was, in fact, having a conversation with her in which we were talking about a difficult subject, something that was difficult for her to handle. And she said to me, she said, I keep thinking of rushing out of this room and throwing myself off the balcony. And it's like, I have had lots of difficult conversations for me, and I never think about going throwing myself off the balcony. But it's in her samskaras, and she's always having to work with it. And in a very real sense, you know, she feels that just to live to the end of her life this time is actual success. Suicide is the ultimate act of complete subconscious self-involvement. There's absolutely no reality. You've forgotten all the other realities, and you try to snuff out consciousness itself. A woman who actually tried to commit suicide and had a death-in-return experience went to a very unpleasant place, which is, most people don't do that. But she shot herself, but then was saved. But she said she felt she was in an astral world with other suicides. She felt a lot of them had been sitting there for a really, really, really long time. And the characteristic of their consciousness was that it was downward looking, it was self-involved, and it was still in that state of nothing can help me. And she said what was so fascinating, because she was going into that state, and she said she'd never been a religious person at all, but for some reason, just the thought of Jesus entered her mind. And as that thought entered her mind, she lifted her eyes, and she realized that there were all these light beings right above where these dark souls were. Because in the astral world, light beings can go down to help people of lower consciousness, but people of lower consciousness can't penetrate higher realms unless they shift. And she saw there were all these light beings just sending light to these suffering souls. And she had looked up, and then she was pulled out of there. So what happens to people who commit suicide is they don't get to escape anything. Whatever unhappiness had them in that state, they live through it in the astral world. However, time is an illusion, and even though it might seem like a long time, in the end, every river finds its way to the ocean. And Swami Kriyananda said something once that is so, it's always been so beautiful to me. He said, now when he sees people suffering, even if intensely suffering, the thought that comes to him is, when they find the bliss of God, it will be even sweeter because of the sadness they've gone through now. And so instead of feeling their sadness, he feels how much sweeter the bliss will be because of what they've experienced now. And I found that just so, it just shifts the whole perspective. The other thing that's worth contemplating is that Master says we all try everything. That, you know, the idea of suicide is such an obvious temptation when we don't understand that consciousness is not shifted by death. And he says, we try it. We all try it. And if we're not inclined to do it now, it's because we live through it. And if somebody you know or love has tried it, well, they're on their way to learning. And you can help them by sending light and prayers because the light beings are trying to help them all the time. Does that help? Yeah. Yes, Vijay.
God may be loving them more, I think. They are helpless.
Yeah.
So he may give a better life for them if that happens.
Karma is fair, though. You can't get a better life just because somebody feels sorry for you. You get a better life when you have raised your consciousness to the point where you can accept a better life. You can't just... I mean... That's why I said why and how you commit suicide matters. If you realize that you've made a terrible mistake and it really wasn't what you wanted, then your consciousness is shifted and you can go forward from there. Master also says that many miscarriages are souls that committed suicide. I mean, I don't want to say that for those women who've had miscarriages that you have to think about that, but that is what he says. Because having repudiated life, They have to work harder to get it again. Like a reincarnation is just not handed to them for nothing. So they'll come into a womb, but not really be able to be born. It was a very interesting point. There are other reasons for miscarriage, but he did mention that as one. You have to appreciate life again. A woman wrote actually in my book Miracles and Answered Prayers. There's a story in there about a woman who had a chronic disease. And she had the intuition, but she didn't universalize, that she'd committed suicide. And so she had earned the right to reincarnate again, but she didn't quite have a full life because she really needed to learn to appreciate what she had cast aside before. So it's just karma is perfectly fair. But it's true that, you know, often the mother loves the black sheep, the one that needs the love more, but the child has to be receptive to it. God, as Master put it, God won't break His own laws. He won't break His own laws. We have to live through them. Yeah. Was another question? Yes.
How do we prepare for the death of our very close ones, like maybe our parents, who we know that they will go through it sooner or later? And secondly, one more thing, that sometimes it happens that we get into a guilt. You know, I've heard many friends that somebody really close to them has died and they feel that, oh, I wish I had done this, after their death. So how does the person who's living with the guilt, how does that person handle that?
Well, that's why I said remain karmically current. Don't acquire debts. There's no other answer to that. If you know you're going to feel guilty, well, for heaven's sakes, fix it now. Because what is the point of just feeling guilty later? How to prepare for the death of parents? This is what I believe. Be generous toward them. I mean, I had a woman friend whose father died. He'd raised 8 children. He'd worked so hard his whole life. He was 85. He was finished. And the daughter, in the name of loving him, kept mourning. I said, it's such a drag on his spirit. I said, give the guy a break, you know? He's ready to do something else. Let him go. Be happy about it. So I think the thing to do, and that's, I'm joking with my husband, you know, I've loved living with you. It's been a joy being your wife. And so I want to always think like that. I've loved having you as my mother. I've loved having you as my father. It's been a joy. And just say that over and over and over again, so that the whole experience of it is that it's been beautiful. But nothing in this world lasts forever. We can be petulant, spoiled children as much as we want to, and it won't have an effect on anything. So the way to get ready is to be a grown person, a mature person, whether you're a child or an adult, and realize that God has a plan. And I need to cooperate with that plan, because when your father and mother are done with their bodies and ready to go, you want to be the friend to them that they have been to you. And if you have this excessive sadness, this excessive guilt, this excessive loneliness, it's not loving them, with all due respect. It's pure selfishness, because that'll drag their energy down. But if instead, you, even as you weep, you know, you've been such a wonderful mother to me, I will miss you so much, but go, mother, go. You know, go on, have a wonderful time, new adventures. You know, you get to be young again. I'll meet you again. We'll be together again. Everything that's real about you is not lost. And, you know, it seems like time, but it's just a moment. Mother, I'll be fine. Father, I'll be fine. Of course I'll miss you. But go, go, go. And think of it in reverse. If your parents had said to you, don't go to college, don't get married, don't get a job. I mean, but that's exactly what we're doing. When people die, and we have such an upset about their dying, they're ready to go on and expand and advance, and we say, no, no, no. Is that love? Who are we thinking about? So we have to practice, but you have to practice being that way all the time. You have to practice recognizing that even though my parents love me, they're completely independent souls with their own destiny. I don't own them. They don't own me. I'm not in charge. We're all doing this thing together, and let us just do it beautifully. And trust, as I was saying in the other classes, which you've heard, that behind every form there's the presence of God. Is that fair? Yeah. I think it's an extremely important point. I'm heartsick to see sometimes how people react to the death of the people they love. Even people, with all due respect, who ought to know better, just become completely self-involved and don't think about the person who's died. And I become heartsick because it doesn't help anybody. You know, and so I hope that there's a whole change in our society, that we all know it's there. Everybody knows they're going to die, but nobody wants to know they're going to die. Yeah. It's the end of our time. I know there's one more question, but it's the end of our time. What were you going
to
say, sir?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you one thing. You know, somewhere I read, you know, like the souls who stay together, let's say in previous reincarnation, they again, next in reincarnations again, they come together. So is there a fact to that? Or?
Absolutely. Master says that the relationships among people go for many, many incarnations. Many, many incarnations. And, you know, sometimes your baby is your grandmother. And you know, just especially if somebody's really attached to certain people, they'll just keep reincarnating in the same place. But everything that's real about your relationship endures, and it just keeps taking new forms and new forms and new forms. Master says, even though forms change, the association among souls is very, very long-lasting, especially among spiritual families. When you become gurubhais, then the relationships, you meet again and again and again. But here's another strange thing. I think this is an autobiography that Lord Buddha said, that at one time or another you've been close to everyone. And, you know, that, the mind just, my mind goes, what? I don't know where to do it. The people that I have associations with, I can imagine, but walking through the market yesterday, all those people, I've been close to all of them, I'll just come back in the house. I don't know what to do about that at all. But that's why Jesus said, how much did you love? How much do you love? Because everything belongs to you.
And that's why I think we have 84 million reincarnations, to be close to everybody.
maybe so. Okay, did you have a question?
Uh-huh. A person who commits a suicide.
Uh-huh.
Is it compulsory that soul goes to...
I'm sorry,
light?
Say that one more time.
Soul goes to the light or not?
A person who commits suicide?
Yeah.
You go...
I don't think it goes to the light.
But no,
it has to come back from there only. And life is much more difficult than earlier. That's what
she said. Well, merely dying doesn't liberate you from your ego. And you simply go to the astral universe that is at the vibration of the total accumulated consciousness. It's not just the last second, but the total accumulated consciousness of your incarnation. You slide right into the astral universe. And many people don't see any light at all because they don't see any light. They're unconscious completely, or if they die in a state of extreme darkness, they go into a dark place. Like that woman who tried to commit suicide, she went where a lot of suicides were, and it was not... They just were terribly unhappy, and they remain terribly unhappy. And we don't merge... Just because we go into the light doesn't mean we merge into the light. We follow the light, but then we follow it into whatever astral world is appropriate for us, and we live there until we're ready to come back. It is nice there, so they say, nicer than here. But everything is intensified. A physical body dulls, both positive and negative, so everything is intensified. So if our consciousness is negative, it's intensely so. If our consciousness is positive, it's more intensely so. For people of refined consciousness, it's more like what we think things should be, just happier, kinder, more harmonious, more beautiful. All right. Is that it then? Okay, everyone, thank you very much.